From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. What does it take for an American police story to pop up on the Australian evening news? Here's what.
Authorities in Texas have found as many as 30 bodies, including possibly those of children, buried in a mass grave at the intersection of two county roads in the southeast part of the state.
It was a grisly and disturbing scenario, triggering all of the revulsion and titillation TV producers count on when true crime intrudes upon our mundane lives. The only problem here was that this incident was actually untrue crime. Yes, local, state, and federal law enforcement did converge on Hardin, Texas, but they found no mass grave, no single grave, no dead children, no dead adults. Nothing but the temporary vacant home of a long-haul trucker and a convoy of satellite vans, including, of course, CNN.
CNN has now confirmed that at least 20 bodies have been found in a home.
Appears to be a mass grave containing, according to a sheriff's department official, 25 to 30 bodies, including, we are told tonight, the bodies of children. And the Liberty County Sheriff's Office says 25 to 30 bodies discovered outside the home there. Investigators said someone told them about the location. They are not elaborating on where that information comes from just yet.
It would rapidly emerge that the whole wild corpse chase began with a phone tip to the Liberty County Sheriff's Department from a woman identifying herself as a psychic, a twist that within 3 hours began to sober up the hysterical domestic news organizations, but not before the Texas Ain't Saw No Massacre was misreported with various forms of attribution the world round, including Agence France-Presse, Reuters, The Guardian, Sky News, the BBC, and The New York Times. But how? How does it come to pass that so many newsrooms could be so careless, so credulous, so clumsy? OTM this week tried to reconstruct the trail of misinformation to find out, as it were, where the bodies weren't buried. Though many outlets cleansed their websites of early versions of the story, our digging was a lot more productive than Liberty County's. It was apparent that London's The Guardian, for instance, grafted its stories from wire dispatches from AFP and Reuters. The New York Times also cited Reuters. But where did Reuters get its information?
Well, I believe it was shortly before 5 p.m. Central Time. We got a breaking news alert from a Houston television station.
Kristen Hayes is a Reuters correspondent in Houston, Texas.
Yes, you know, we signed up email-wise to get breaking news alerts from all the local media around here. So the typical Reuters way to handle that is to flash out the initial news and cite it to local media. So that's what we did. You know, Texas authorities find up to 30 bodies, including children buried at house-local media.
Reuters was not alone. By this stage, Twitter was ringing off the hook with retweets of the same news alerts. BreakingNews.com, on its website and on Twitter, passed this along to its 2.6 million followers. Dozens of bodies found buried in Texas, KPRC. This was retweeted hundreds of times, and at least it had some sort of source, KPRC. KPRC's original news alert contained no source. It flatly stated, dozens of bodies have been found in Liberty County. Join us for KPRC at 5 p.m. for the latest information. All of those organizations stayed with the story, later fleshing it out, both with gory details and attribution to law enforcement officials. But by then, the internet had long since exploded.
I believe that the dissemination of incorrect information was actually twofold.
Captain Rex Evans is public information officer for the Liberty County Sheriff's Department.
I believe that not only mainstream media, but social media played an integral part in that. And by that, I mean not any one particular person or any one particular station, news or radio, heard information that they had not yet been able to completely verify, yet that information was released. Now, in social media, obviously, nobody has to verify anything. You can get on to Facebook, emails,
Twitter,
and you can disseminate whatever information you want. The problem with that is some people perhaps don't stop and think what they are releasing or putting out there could actually be harmful to someone else. It certainly slowed us down and impaired our investigation due to the fact we were dealing with so much of a media onslaught, if you will.
Evans neglects to mention that the media circus would likely have been a one-ring affair had his office mentioned from the get-go that the whole investigation hinged on a phone tip from a self-professed psychic. The moment that detail emerged, about 2 hours into the frenzy, journalistic skepticism began to materialize.
I mean, we were already somewhat skeptical, but of course that immediately sent off all the alarms and whistles that this was, in all likelihood, a bogus story.
Mike Tolson covered the story for the Houston Chronicle, which never told readers in print or online that the mass grave story was anything more than an unconfirmed report. But there was a bear market for skepticism in Texas that afternoon. For most newsrooms, citing other newsrooms as the source was a good enough first step.
Oh, no, we never reported that. And I don't know how anyone in their right mind or with an iota of professionalism in their veins could have reported such a thing absent any confirmation from anybody. You know, I think one of our editors said he gives it a 10% chance of panning out. And then when we heard from some law enforcement source that it was a person claiming to be a psychic, well, you know, then it was a 1% chance of panning out.
It made headlines all around the world after reports of 30 decomposing bodies, including children, said to be in some cases mutilated and dumped in a rural area outside Houston. The FBI got involved. The cops brought. It was a crazy scene, but they found nothing.
No graves, no evidence of any murder. Now the investigation is turning to the tipster. Authorities saying it was from a woman claiming to be a psychic.
Police and news crews took the tip seriously because the woman gave very detailed information about that house. Authorities found no bodies and no evidence of foul play.
When the lurid details began to be impeached by on-the-scene reality, one after another, the gathering truth was disturbing in its own right. Reuters' Kristen Hayes.
Well, the best way to describe it is an extremely ice-cold feeling in the pit of your stomach when you begin to realize, wait a minute, this may not be right. This may not be true.
That sickening feeling still lingered on Thursday over at KPRC, Houston's Channel 2, whose original unequivocal news alert seems to have been the first journalistic salvo in the worldwide bombardment. News director Deborah Kalura, in a speakerphone interview along with her general manager Jerry Martin, was adamant in pointing out that the newsroom does observe standards of sourcing, which is why she insisted that she didn't let the mass grave story go on her 4 p.m. broadcast absent official confirmation.
I'm never going to go on the air unless my reporters are on the scene telling me there are 25 to 30 children's bodies, you know, being dug up in a grave. And we never said anything on the air.
But why do you keep making this distinction between on the air and on the web and on Twitter? I mean, this is 2011. They're all the same, aren't they? Aren't the rules the same covering each of those channels of news distribution?
You've got a whole newsroom that has access to tweeting someone who isn't going to be on air, like an anchor or a reporter.
Obviously got overly aggressive with the story and tweeted something that did not go through the checks and balance system.
And we can't find the source at the moment.
Yes, the TV news is delivered by your Channel 2 news team. The website is controlled by the Click 2 Houston web team. But any one of 30 KPRC employees can tweet about anything under KPRC's handle, and management can't even identify who tweeted what when.
And I have to tell you, just to learn later that it was because of a psychic tip. We all went on this chase because we thought we were covering a story. I mean, I just got to be honest with you. We're all upset at this point.
Not just because they uncritically passed along bad information without attribution, but because, Kalura insists, they did have attribution, which they used in all subsequent reports. Their source? The cops.
The way the event unfolded was probably around 3:30, 3:45 in our newsroom, we received a call from the Liberty County Sheriff's Department. And that would be the PIO, the person we get our information from.
Rex Evans?
Yes. Saying that there was a report of 25 to 30 bodies that had been found on this County Road 2048, County Road 2049, and that police were on the way to this scene. That's how the whole event started. So it did not start with a tweet from us, just so I can set the record straight.
Oddly, in his conversation with us, Captain Evans talked a lot about unverified information, but didn't mention any 330 call to his contacts at the TV stations. He instead offered a different theory for rumors of the investigation leaking out.
People see multiple patrol cars in an area, and they start tweeting or texting or Facebooking from their iPads and what have you that, hey, the cops are over here looking at whatever, and it just goes from there, and it just spreads like a wildfire.
Yeah, and it spreads even faster when the cops are lighting the match. But in any case, like they always say, bad news travels fast. Coming up, curating an exhibition of the earliest incarnations of the internet is like digging up ancient history. This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Reputation.com, with tools designed to help doctors, lawyers, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. In the digital world, everything progresses kind of fast, doubling every which way, according to Moore's Law, every 2 years. The World Wide Web expands at least as geometrically. In 1997, there were about 50 million unique URLs. Today, about 3 trillion, and they represent perhaps as little as 1/500th of the so-called deep web. As that e-universe expands in a nearly Einsteinian way, time seems to contract, distorting the scale of history itself. So now, to unearth the lost treasures of creation, comes a new branch of research, digital archaeology. The new discipline was on display this week in New York City, where curator Jim Bolton stood above a sleek black box about a foot cubed, tracing back to the beginning of time, 1991, that is.
We've actually managed to get hold of a Next Cube, which is the machine that the World Wide Web was invented on.
This was a Steve Jobs piece of hardware after he left Apple, founded Next.
Yes, and it's interesting because when Tim Berners-Lee first invented the web page, of course, he also had to invent a browser to access that web page, and we've actually managed to track down that browser at the same time, and we're really happy to have been able to reunite the first website with the first browser and the computer it was invented on.
What the monitor displays actually isn't the first ever web page. This is a version circa 1992.
One tragedy, actually, is that the very first web page no longer exists. There's no record of it, there's no archive, there's not even a screenshot. So that monumental point in history has been lost forever. And I think that's typical of the industry. You know, and it kind of highlights the issue that we're trying to raise here, that we're in real danger of not having a full and comprehensive record of this crucial period that's changed our lives forever.
It all seems so unlikely. You'd think that if there were one thing easy to unearth after a mere 20 years, it's a bunch of ones and zeros. But as it turns out, no. One problem is that as technology evolves, we actually discard the hardware and software that made the old stuff work. Bolton's team spent months haunting eBay and brick-and-mortar recycling centers looking for the ancient artifacts dating clear back to the George H.W. Bush administration. Here is David Michel Davies, chair of Internet Week, the Umbrella Event housing the exhibit.
So to look at a website in its original form from 1996, you actually can't do it unless you're looking at it on a computer that's from around that era, on a browser that's from around that era, because all these things function together, and when you sort of take one of them out, it all stops working. So the hardware is really cool to look at, but it's actually necessary in order to run some of these sites that we're looking at.
You know, I'm so old that I am experiencing actual evolution. I mean, there are species changes in my lifetime. Never mind, you know, an old power book. So it's hard for me to process the idea that this is archaeology. But I guess it is archaeology, huh?
He really excavated these websites. And he went and he got this source code from the people who created these that were files. And there's all this sort of, like, cruff around it. You know, there's things that don't really work anymore that wouldn't work today. And he literally had to go into that code and have people sort of dust off some of the code that's too old to render and push it away and really just get at the core of the source so that he could then put it up on some of these computers in some of these browsers. So in that sense, like, he really did dig away and excavate it. So, you know, I think it is a new form of archaeology.
Thank God for the diggers. It is amazing to see the old PCs, the early iMacs looking like day-glow helium balloons, the earliest versions of web animation, Word.com, a pioneering e-zine, and more than two dozen other bygone sites you can interact with as if you'd gone back in time. I tried to interact with the famous 2004 Burger King website, SubservientChicken.com, which allows you to issue orders to a man in a chicken suit, any kind of orders. But that went poorly.
I typed in wear pantyhose, and that's clearly a garter.
I had much better luck with Exhibit 28, which is from way back in right now. The Wilderness Downtown allows you to create a movie about a solitary figure haunting the streets of any neighborhood you happen to type in, all to the music of Arcade Fire.
What you do is you type in the address of your hometown and it will create a personalized video for you based on Google Maps showing someone running around the streets of your hometown. And again, it raises the question, how do you archive an individual experience like that?
So I'm going to type in a hometown of my youth, Ballykinwid, Pennsylvania. Oh, wow. The leitmotif is these birds, a wing in the sky, and it's superimposing them over satellite views of Ballykinwid. Now we're seeing street views in another window. Oh, my God. Kind of amazing. So it looks like a custom-made film that happens to be situated in my hometown.
I think what's interesting is the way we've come full circle. The very first websites, they had to be experiential. There was no other reason to visit a website apart from it being an experience. And then when e-commerce kicked off and it became very commercial, all of a sudden it was about the transaction. And now with the rise of the social web, where we can easily reject products and services and commercial messages, again, it has to be experiential again. Otherwise, there's no reason to visit the site. And I think we can learn a lot from these young pioneers of the early web.
A little stroll down random access memory lane can be illuminating and also pretty hilarious. To offer context, each of the 30-some PCs, Macs, and Next machines were accompanied by the same year's model of cell phone, some the size of bricks, and by a contemporaneous issue of Wired magazine. Randall Rothenberg, president and CEO of the Interactive Advertising Bureau, amused himself with the cover story from March 1997 when he was a Wired contributor.
The cover story is all about the idea that push was going to replace the browsers as the next big interface. It's just so amusing in its wrongheadedness.
Could you read that?
Yeah. Kiss Your Browser Goodbye, The Radical Future of Media Beyond the Web by the editors of Wired. Remember the browser war between Netscape and Microsoft? Well, forget it. The web browser itself is about to croak, and good riddance.
Okay. Oops. It's hard to predict the future, even when the future is only just over the horizon. I asked Rothenberg, who represents the sponsors of our online lives, how worried he is about losing the artifacts of our online lives.
Just kind of changes the way we think of kind of our cultural present and cultural heritage. But I'm not sure if it's a problem. I think we'll know that in 50 or 100 years.
One of the sponsors of the digital archaeology exhibit, a little outfit called Google, thinks it knows the answer right now. We gotta save this stuff. Amon Govil, a Google marketing manager, was on hand truly admiring the unearthed treasures.
Isn't it weird to look at 1994 as history? I mean, I think I still have stuff in my fridge from 1994.
It depends on what the context of history is, right? Like, I probably have shirts older than some of the websites around here. But the internet evolves faster than almost any other thing in our life. Like, you go to YouTube, right? 3 months ago, the stuff you had on YouTube is like ancient history. And it's just that pace that is evolving, which if you think about it, 2 decades of internet, to me, it just sounds like history. And if you...
You mean like, Charlie bit my finger. Oh, that was so February.
Exactly. But now, you know, what's the new one? What's her name? Rebecca Black.
It's Friday.
You look at cars, for example, right? A basic setup of a car hasn't changed in the last 20 years. Yeah, you've gotten more toys inside it and, you know, better buttons and better leather and everything. But the internet has just completely changed. It's like going from bicycles to, you know, supersonic jets in 16 years. So when you look at it in that context of how quickly everything has evolved, 1994 is definitely history. It's ancient history on the internet. Like, some of these computers that you see out here, like, they belong in a museum and not on your desktop.
Reasonable point, but here's a better one. Rebecca Black, the tween sensation with 160 million online hits, is pretty much over too. Her video is 4 months old, a relic, an antiquity. Friday is history. Remember it well.
I don't want this weekend to end.
R.B. Rebecca Black. So chillin' in the front side,
in the back seat.
I'm driving, cruising, fast lanes, switching lanes with a car by my side. Passing by is a school bus in front of me. Makes TikTok, wanna stream. Check my time, it's Friday, it's a weekend. We gonna have fun. Come on, y'all.
The notion of vanishing internet history did not begin with Internet Week. Entrepreneur, philanthropist, and digital librarian Brewster Kahle recognized this in 1996. And began a monumental undertaking, the Internet Archive, an attempt to preserve and make accessible all that is so fleeting online. But a funny thing happened on the way to Internet posterity. Kahle says that his archive hard drives lasted only for 3 to 5 years, and as he sizes up the outdated technology surrounding him, he's arrived at a whole new appreciation of the solidity and necessity of books, so much so that in addition to his ongoing internet archive, he's launched a new ambitious physical library. Brewster, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Last we spoke was about 5 years ago, and you were all charged up because at the time you were like backing up trucks to loading docks and spilling huge hoppers full of zeros and ones into the trucks. And you were going to store all of these zeros and ones in perpetuity. It was the Internet Archive. You called it the Wayback Machine. But you've had kind of a change of heart. Tell me about that.
Yes. Well, we've been digitizing a lot of materials and collecting all the born digital materials, everybody's web pages, and storing it and trying to do as good a job as we can. But now people have started giving us physical books. And then the question is, after they're digitized, is there any real reason to have the physical books? And we're determining, yes, there absolutely is. We're discovering what librarians have known for centuries in this new digital world. So I'm feeling like a little naive.
Now, it seems to me that one of the motives for archiving things digitally is because the storage space is trivial compared to the physical storage space required to house actual paper books, which are fragile, which are heavy, oddly shaped, and so on. Isn't this kind of an awkward proposition? You know, building a library?
Building a library of physical books or keeping them around makes all the sense in the world, we think, that as digitization of books is going through, it's not only changing how people access library materials, it's also changing how libraries preserve physical books. And we've just launched a new system for doing even higher density storage, long-term preservation that allows us to store millions of books without going broke or using up large amounts of acreage. We now have the space for 1 million books, but we've designed this to be able to get to 10 million books easily. 10 million books is the number of books at the Boston Public Library or a Yale or a Princeton.
The new Library of Alexandria.
Well, hopefully we have a different ending than they did.
There are others who, I'm thinking of the Library of Congress, to pick one obvious one, that already archives physical paper books. Tell me why you're not reinventing the wheel.
Library of Congress is doing a great job. They get donations of materials because they get legal deposit of everything that's published in the United States. And they hold on to, I guess from their website, they say about a half of it. The idea of having all of this in one place makes no sense. The history of libraries is one that's fraught with destruction. Large central libraries tend to be destroyed. So the idea is to have distributed responsibility, distributed organizations, distributed approaches to long-term preservation of what we think is valuable.
For research or for archival purposes, it's hard for me to understand why the paper book needs to be preserved. Why doesn't a digital image do the trick right nice?
Hopefully the digital image will satisfy, well, the people that are now on the net. But there are real reasons to keep the physical materials. Look back at microfilm. When microfilm was done, that was the access format of a previous generation. And that was the format to end all formats. Well, we now know it wasn't the format to end all formats. Or even the Google Book Project. They've digitized an enormous number of books, but they've done it in such a way that it kind of looks like a fax. So I think we can do a better job. And the digitization that we're doing, we think is absolutely fabulous. But there's going to be things we want to do next. And I think we can only kind of dream a little bit about how we might want to use these physical collections next.
I gather that in some ways you deem this to be an antidote to some of Google's practices in compiling its digital versions.
It's very tempting to just go and acquire books and just saw off the bindings and digitize them. You get a better digitization. It's much cheaper to do. But there's something in our stomachs that just grind when we think about butchering books. Kevin Kelly put it, hey, I understand what you're doing. You're keeping the type specimen, the one of that particular ant that is the one that we're describing as the one for that species.
You should call this Noah's Archive.
Google has done this amazing thing. They've been digitizing lots of books, and they will have, in fact, digitized two different copies from different places. And if they either didn't digitize a page very well, or there was a torn out, which does happen, they can put it back together again such that they make a new digital version that's out of multiple, which seems terrific, but it's also a little creepy. What's the real thing here?
It's not a facsimile. It's kind of a Frankenstein's monster.
I wouldn't put it in a negative way. I think it's actually they're doing a high value add, but I think we really want to know where it came from and be able to make sure that we understand what's happened. The opportunity to live in an Orwellian or a Fahrenheit 451 type world where things are changed out from underneath us is very much present in our digital world. Let's make sure we put in place the long-term archives to make it so that we can check up on those that are presenting things in the future.
Has this new venture, the collection and storage of physical books, dimmed your enthusiasm for the Internet Archive project? Have you given up on the zeros and ones that we talked about to begin this conversation?
There's been an evolution towards just thinking we should just grab the digital stuff and store it because people weren't doing a good job of storing it in the past, to really broadening up to understanding both the preservation and the access. But I'm still extremely enthusiastic about the new types of materials and the new challenges we have. Trying to keep up with a YouTube or Google Video and Yahoo Video are just getting shut down now. GeoCities is already gone. Flickr, I don't know how long that's going to last. Boy, we've got some real work to do. It's never a dull day here at the Internet Archive.
Brewster, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
Brewster Kahle is founder and digital librarian of the Internet Archive. Coming up, where can a grown man live as an 11-year-old girl? Where else but Second Life? A new documentary blurs the line between real and virtual in the Second Life universe. This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Reputation.com, with tools designed to help doctors, lawyers, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. On the Media is also supported by The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world, and the connections between them on newsstands, iPhone and iPad, and at The Economist Online. The Kauffman Foundation, working to grow economies and expand human welfare. Learn more at Kauffman.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Right now, thousands of people are logged into a virtual world called Second Life. It's not quite a video game. There aren't any fixed goals or enemies, and you can't really lose. It's more like playing make-believe, but plugged in, online, and with adults dressed up digitally as avatars of their own creation. In Second Life's virtual world, people reinvent themselves, age, race, body type, gender, and then they build virtual cities, create virtual goods, and forge relationships which, though interlaced with fantasy, are nonetheless real. Filmmaker Jason Spingarn Coff spent years inside Second Life as he attempted to understand how time spent in the virtual world shapes our life in the flesh and blood one. His documentary follows three remarkable stories of life in the virtual world. You see infidelity in progress, gender confusion, theft, litigation, even a virtual shooting spree.
She would go in with the tag that says suicide bomber with the explosive vest on and got a few weapons, all of the gadgets she had that could do the most damage to other residents.
What the film attempts to show is that virtual life, just like real life, can be complicated. It can be rewarding, and it can be heartbreaking. I asked Jason Spingarn Coff why people go into Second Life.
The promise is pretty amazing. This is a world on the computer where you can be whoever you want to be. You can construct a whole new identity, and then you can travel to all these fantastic places like tropical beaches or snow-covered mountains. Anything you can imagine people have built within Second Life. And then there's an economy which uses real money. Also, no one knows who you really are in Second Life. So there's a chance to have this alternate identity where you can express things that you may not be able to express in your day-to-day life.
So it's tabula rasa. You get to start from scratch and build your life exactly as you wish for it to be constructed, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then you meet other people and you forge friendships. And if you're a creative person, you can start building things. You can build houses or clothes. You can even rent a piece of land and get your little virtual seaside cottage or seaside mansion and feel that you have everything you always dreamed that you had in your real life, maybe things you could never attain.
Which is swell, but as your film explores, you can't help but have your second life intrude to one degree or another in your first life. You had three sets of characters, a couple named Amy and Stephen, who we see in the process of forging an extramarital affair, a woman named Azuri, who actually earns her livelihood in Second Life by designing clothes and houses and other things that are actually sold for cash dollars on Second Life. And a guy who I think of as Mr. X, who is a young man whose avatar on Second Life is a little girl named Aya. How did you come upon this cast of characters?
Well, I spent hundreds of hours in Second Life meeting avatars, exploring. Everywhere I looked, I just found more and more fascinating little islands and subcultures. And my avatar is a cameraman avatar named Jay Spire. And I would go around and meet people like a journalist might in the real world. And other people found me once they learned about what I was doing. And then I also went to conferences where Second Life people would gather. And that's a great opportunity because at least you know the people behind the avatar. One of the greatest challenges in making the film is that people guard their real-life identity so much in Second Life. and often they don't want to reveal who they are.
Well, that would certainly apply to Mr. X. The guy whose avatar is an 11-year-old girl named Aya, here is him talking about that.
She loves to dance. That's been sort of her calling in life. And Second Life is a great place for dancing. I think of myself as an observer, maybe sort of a driver, because she's guiding me and she knows what she wants me to do, and I do it.
Now, we come to discover that while this guy articulates a reason that this isn't creepy, that his life, his real life, is very complicated and maybe even pathological. But you were satisfied from the beginning, I gather, that he wasn't some sort of internet predator who was disguising himself as an 11-year-old girl in order to meet other 11-year-old girls online, right?
I was confident he was not a predator. In talking with him, he really wanted to share his story for two reasons. One, because he was trying to understand internet addiction. He contacted me only about a week after he first went into Second Life and was very frightened about what was going on with him. And the second part was to show me what this world is all about, of adults who have child avatars, and that there was a lot of misconception in the media that this was largely a sexual subculture. But it's really so much more complicated than that. Most of the adults who roleplay children are doing it for reasons such as a lost childhood or things that they may not understand. And this particular man wound up discovering something about himself that he could never talk about to anyone else. And he credits Second Life with helping him deal with this incredible trauma he experienced.
But in the process, he spends 14, 16, 18, 20 hours a day on Second Life, forsaking the real world in the process. Another character was so immersed in Second Life that she seems, at least based on your film, to scarcely have had a flesh and blood one. That's Azuri. I assume these are not the norm.
Well, Second Life has about 800,000 users a month right now. And of those, most of the people are not on it 24 hours a day. But there is a subset of that. There was a study that about 44,000 users spend 50 hours a week or more in Second Life. And half of them are spending 10 hours a day or more. So that's, you know, you've got more than 20,000 people who are in there full time.
Let's talk about Azuri for a moment. She is the woman who actually built a business there. And on one level, she is charming and poised and witty and in many ways has it together as she figures out a way to sell virtual stuff to real people inhabiting a virtual world. But she's also all in Second Life. It's her social life. It's her business. All her eggs are in the Second Life basket, which, at the risk of being a spoiler here, winds up causing a great deal of grief. Tell me a bit about Azuri.
Well, Azuri is, I think, a really terrific, charismatic, creative person who happens to live with her parents in Detroit, working out of the basement. At least when I was filming her, she was pretty much in Second Life every waking hour. Second Life was just a dream for her when she discovered it. She could play a video game, and she could design, and she could get paid for it. And she made, at one point, six figures a year, and that's in real dollars.
Wow. Until something bad happens, a kind of mundane, earthly sort of ripoff crime, right?
Yeah, well, the virtual world is such a mirror of the real world that human nature runs its course, and there is crime in the virtual world. And Azuri becomes the victim of a crime. It's a fascinating case, actually, which resulted in the first lawsuit where avatars sued other avatars for intellectual property theft.
On the subject of the overlap between flesh and blood behaviors and Second Life, there is the story of Amy and Steven, whose avatars met and whose avatars fell in love. And next thing you know, Steven is leaving his real life in Canada to join Amy in New York. And, you know, and they're both married people. There's
one sequence, Jason, where we see Amy and Steven on Second Life talking to one another. And Amy is interrupted by her husband. She goes to the door of her study to talk to him and then comes back and says, "That was my husband. He's suspicious of what I'm up to." At that stage, I'm a little suspicious too, on the grounds of too good to be true for a documentarian to be present for this exchange. How did you score that sequence?
Well, one of the beauties of filming people in Second Life is it's really not that hard to be there often. All I would need to do was be in my apartment in New York, logged into Second Life, and then Amy could be logged in from New York and Steven could be logged in from Canada. And we would meet and we would have interviews together. And, you know, when people are engaged in a very high-risk activity like having an affair, I think there's lots of dramatic moments, probably all the time. So if you're kind of in the right place at the right time, interesting things will happen.
I was stunned at how they'd expose themselves. I don't know if it's exhibitionism or what. There's another scene later when they've already left their respective spouses where Steven's still in Canada, Amy is in her place in New York, and they're speaking sort of halfway between Second Life and the real world digitally via Skype. They're both in bed saying goodnight to each other.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Yeah. Hi, sweetheart.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you? How was your day?
Do you have any insight as to what would motivate them to open up their lives at such grave risk to themselves?
Well, at this point in the relationship, things were going really well. They were really excited to be sharing with the world this virtual love story. And there are many people out there who are having these types of relationships, whether it's in Second Life or other online worlds or in Facebook. Apparently now Facebook is one of the leading sources of evidence in divorce proceedings right now because there are so many online affairs through Facebook. Amy was also thinking that if things don't turn out well, this would be an important cautionary story for other people.
So now that you've documented these, all of which resulted in one level or another of extreme real-world unhappiness, if you were to write a disclaimer that was to appear on the screen for everyone signing up for Second Life, for their blank slate to begin, what would the disclaimer say?
Warning, Second Life is real. Because it is real. It's not physical, but it's real. What makes the virtual world real is that the people are real, and the relationships are real, and the emotions are real. And some people may not realize that going in. But that's what makes Second Life so powerful, and that's why people stay there and why some people get hooked.
Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jason Spingarn-Koff is the creator of Life 2.0, which will appear on Oprah Winfrey's own channel in August. You may have noticed that at this point in the show, you have not heard mention of Anthony Weiner. That's because we figure everything there is to be said about the Democratic congressman's abusive and pathetic sexting behavior has been said. But not without difficulty, because every time you do try to do Weiner coverage, you confront such dubious phrases as Weiner coverage.
I love the Weiner, even the congressman. I love him too.
We do.
But
the challenge was not made any easier by the smirking wordplay of the nation's most notorious arrested adolescent himself.
You know, this is part of the problem with the way this has progressed, and one of the reasons why I was perhaps, if you give me a little bit stiff yesterday.
Luckily, where taste and judgment fail, technology offers a solution. University of Washington computer scientists recently unveiled a semantic software that can recognize sexually suggestive sentences before it's too late. The program is called Double Entendre Via Noun Transfer, or Deviant for short, but what it really does is just automate the creation of the old-fashioned "That's what she said" joke. Writer Jacob Aaron reported on it for New Scientist magazine. Jacob, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much.
So tell me, first of all, what is a "That's what she said" joke?
It's not a very funny joke. It's not a very original joke, but someone says something and you realize that you can twist their words another way by saying "That's what she said" and sort of reveal a hidden meaning that perhaps they hadn't intended.
So you smirkingly flag that a double entendre maybe has occurred.
Yes.
All right, now, you know, I don't know a whole lot about the semantic web, but my understanding is it is very difficult for software to really have enough understanding of the context of conversational language to divine intent, you know, much less naughty double meanings. How do they do that?
Basically, they use the same methods that Google uses to understand all of the web pages out there. They scan a huge amount of data and try and identify certain statistical properties that will flag up a "That's what she said" joke versus something that isn't a joke.
And I'm curious, the researchers, what was this, an academic exercise? Was it a party game? What motivated them to devote whatever they devoted to make this software work?
Well, I mean, I'm not exactly sure what their intent was. I'm sure they didn't spend, you know, sort of years trying to crack this. But they presented their work at a conference on computational linguistics. So there is a serious intent to it. It's basically we're trying to teach computers to understand writing and voice, all that kind of stuff. And these kind of methods, you know, it is silly, but if we can teach a computer to understand a joke, we're one step closer to a computer being able to understand anything, really.
Tell me the form that the program takes. Does it scan the web looking for "That's what she said" opportunities? What do it do?
So basically, I think you feed it a sentence, and it will tell you it has to reach a certain threshold. And once it reaches that threshold, it says, yes, it would be funny to say "That's what she said."
If you typed in, "This is a hard story to report,"
it would certainly come back and say, "That's what she said," I think.
How accurate is the "That's what she said" machine?
So the system's actually about 70% accurate, which doesn't sound very good, but it's because of the mix of the data that they used to train the system. So they had 1.5 million erotic sentences, but only about 60,000 regular sentences. And they say, you know, if they'd better balance their data, they'd be able to get better accuracy, maybe even as good as 99.5%. Tingle was only one of a few that it couldn't come up with. It did manage to get, "Don't you think these buns are a little too big for this meat," which I think is a particularly good one.
You ended your piece with a "That's what she said" joke. How did that work out?
Well, it's not a very good "That's what she said" joke. They say the technique of metaphorical mapping may be generalized to identify other types of double entendres and other forms of humor. And "That's what she said," of course, because one of the researchers is a woman.
I get it. So, in fact, "That's what she said" was an accurate attribution.
Yeah.
But it was not a double entendre.
No.
You devil. Jacob, thank you very much.
Great talking to you.
Jacob Aaron is a technology reporter at The New Scientist. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Asiya Bamdawi, with more help from Emily Chin and Joe Rosenberg, and edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe. Ellen Horn is WNYC's Senior Director of National Programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, and you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
That's what she said.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.